his tie. If you look at it, it's a tie for a bibliophile. You know what a bibliophile is? A book lover. Well, he loves books, and so do I. And if you look at his tie, it's just the right sort of tie for a bibliophile. Page 80, if you'll turn to your study manuals. I stopped it sort of in the middle of this incident. I thought it better to do that than race too much and miss the real import of what's happening here. And that is that Christian in the Palace Beautiful has already been investigated. This is typical of Puritan life. They often dealt with all sorts of temptations and trials that Christians faced. They sometimes called them cases of conscience. And there are lots of books dealing with this. And we've already seen really Christian going under that sort of type of investigation, discussion for membership, and then, you know, they're getting more information about his conversion, and maybe I think they're looking where he needs help. But anyway, after this investigation with these ladies, and again, you've got the porter. I think that's he's an elder or he's a in a leadership role. Then you've got the ladies, prudence, piety, and charity, and discretion. You've got these ladies having a pretty major role here. I myself believe the emphasis here is Bunyan. Not so much having any thoughts. I know he didn't have any thoughts about, you know, women having eldership role in the church, but rather their titles indicate the purity, the virtue of the church itself. That's what they represent, I believe. And then we find Christian is told it's supper time. Supper time is when believers meet around the Lord's table. As I've said before, this is the one repeatable ordinance for the Christian. The Lord's table is a gospel remembrance feast. The Lord's table is a sanctifying gospel remembrance feast, and that's why we are to remember the Lord's table often. Some believers very wrongly try to portray the atonement of Christ as being initiatory, sort of a beginning of what it is to be a Christian, but that's when I was converted. And yet, again, you see, Paul says, God forbid that I should be glorying, save in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ. And for Paul, his hope is in the gospel, his life is the gospel, and that's what is being portrayed here. The gospel is for the nourishment of Christians. At the top there, we're being told about the essence of this supper time. Look there at the top of page 80. But that which put the glory of grace into all which he did in this remembrance supper time was the fact that he did it out of pure love for his country. And besides this, there were some of the household that said they had seen and spoken with him following his death on the cross. And they further testified, having received it from his own lips, that he was such a lover of pilgrims that his likeness was not to be found from the east to the west. Moreover, they gave an instance of what they had just declared, and it was that he had stripped himself of his glory so that he might do this for the poor, and that they had heard him affirm that he would not dwell in Mount Zion alone. Furthermore, they said that he had made many pilgrims into princes, even though they were born beggars and their nature originated from the dunghill. Isn't that marvelous language there? Again, this Lord they're remembering around this table here is one who has elevated men from the dunghill up to be princes, you see. So they discoursed together until late at night. And after they had committed themselves in prayer to their Lord for protection, they went to bed. For the pilgrim, they provided a large upstairs chamber with windows that opened toward the rising of the sun. The name of the room was Peace. And there he slept until the next day dawned. Then on arising that morning, he joyfully sang, "Where am I now? Is this the love and care of Jesus for the men that pilgrims are? Thus to provide that I should be forgiven and dwell already the next door to heaven?" Now I want you to notice what is the effect of the supper time. Two areas, peace and rest. to go to bed, he's given a room, you see, that's called peace. He goes to bed and he rests. And I would suggest that the great purpose of the Lord's table is when saints meet around there and take the mere earthly emblems to remember their risen Savior, they really, these emblems and this remembrance and this musing on Christ crucified, frequently, it's like musing on the embroidered coat too. This is to be productive of peace and rest. I'm confirmed in my faith. That's what the Lord's table is about. We are forgetful. We need to be reminded frequently that our only hope of heaven is Jesus, thy blood and righteousness, thy beauty is my glorious dress. That's what this is about. The other thing is too, notice in that little verse there, where am I now? Is this the love and care of Jesus for the men that pilgrims are? Thus to provide that I should be forgiven and dwell already the next day, door to heaven? That's what a local church ought to be. It is a outpost in a dry and weary land. It's almost, when you get inside, it's like being almost next to heaven. It ought to be. That's the point, you see. It ought to be. I shared with you, Pastor, a verse here from a poem that John Bunyan wrote. It's in his works in Volume 2. This is a poem of 1,310 lines. And the title is A Discourse of the Building, Nature, Excellency, and Government of the House of God. It's all about the local church. Let me read you a few lines here. Listen to these. It's choice. And again, he's describing what goes on in a local church. Alas, here's children who are great with young. Here are the sick and weak as well as strong. Here are the cedar, shrub, and bruised reed. Yea, here are such who wounded are and bleed. Some here are who in their grammar be. Some here are others in their ABC. Some apt to teach and others hard to learn. Some see far off and others can scarce discern. Isn't that timeless? As to what life in a local church will be like. Now we press on again in page 80 down in paragraph C, little way on there. First they took him into the study. This is a tour of the palace, various rooms. The study where they pointed out records of the greatest antiquity. And these, as I recall in my dream, they first explained the pedigree of the Lord of the Hill, that he was the son of the Ancient of Days, and was begotten by an eternal generation. Bunyan is no doctrinal slouch. We'll see this later on. I'll prove this. You see, this is not a book for boys and girls, really. It's an adult book. Notice how he describes Christ here, you see, and he describes him begotten by an eternal generation. He's being doctrinally precise about the eternality of Jesus Christ, though he'd be a son. Also here was more fully recorded the acts or deeds that he had accomplished and the names of many hundreds that he had recruited into his service and how he had placed them in habitations that would never pass away, whether by means of earthly decay or the passing of time. Right-hand column much further down there. Next day they led him into the armory where they showed him a great variety of military weapons. In other words, according to Ephesians 6, the weapons of our warfare. Military weapons, which their Lord had specially provided for pilgrims. There was the sword, shield, helmet, breastplate, and all prayer, and shoes that would never wear out. Moreover, there was enough of the equipment in store to outfit as many men for the service of the Lord as there were multitudes in the stars of heaven. Over the page, a little way down, they also showed him the jawbone with which Samson did such mighty feats. Moreover, they showed him the sling and stone with which David slew Goliath. There was also on display the sword with which their Lord would eventually use to kill the man of sin on that day of final victory over his predator. Besides these, they showed Christians many excellent things that so delighted him. So this day being concluded, they all went to bed once again. Notice again, an aspect of church, it's to be a place of instruction in the Word of God.
Then I saw in my dream that on the next day the pilgrim rose, expecting to press forward on his journey, but the palace company invited him to stay with them yet one more day. They added, "We will, if the day is clear, show you the delectable mountains," which again he will eventually reach and reside in for a while there. "These will further add to your comfort because they are much nearer to the celestial city than your present location." So Christian agreed to stay. When the next morning came, they took Christian to the top of the palace and directed him to look south. In doing this, he beheld a great distance away a very pleasant section of mountainous country. There he saw beautiful woods, vineyards, fruit trees of all sorts. There were also flowers as well as springs and fountains. In all of it was very appealing to look upon. So he asked the name of this country, and they said it was Emmanuel's land. They further explained that for future pilgrims it was the same character as the hill on which their palace was located. Then they announced, "When you arrive at that place, their resident shepherds will direct your eyes toward the near site of the very gate of the celestial city." Now, Bunyan again is injecting here what's ahead of them, and he's merely teaching there will be continuous pastoral oversight. He's going to leave the palace beautiful. Does that indicate, well, that's just for a season? No. When they get to the Delectable Mountains, there'll be resident shepherds, pastors, if you like. There'll be four of them, you see. And one will be called Knowledge, one will be called Experience, another Watchful, another Sincere. And those Delectable Mountains, there'll be further care and nurture and feeding, you see. Then in paragraph D, "Now he decided to prepare himself for moving ahead once again. But first," said the companions, "let us return to the armory." So they did this, and when Christian entered the room, he was equipped from head to foot with fully tested weapons, lest he should encounter assaults along the way. In other words, take to yourself the whole armor of God. "Thus, having been well accoutred or outfitted, he was escorted by his friends to the palace gate, where he asked the porter if he had seen any other pilgrims pass by. To this the porter answered, 'Yes. Do tell me if you know him by name.' I did ask his name, and he told me it was Faithful. 'Oh, I know him. He was a fellow countryman and near neighbor. He comes from the city of destruction where I was born. How far ahead do you think he may have gone?' 'By this time, he has probably passed beyond the bottom of the hill.'" Now, here's a question. I'm going to inject another problem, a really interesting one. Christian, having come from the city of destruction, has come this far. There's another pilgrim back there called Faithful. He comes on the same journey, goes through the wicket gate, and when he comes to the palace, you can tell now that he has come to the palace, but he's passed by. He doesn't stay there. And we're told now he's ahead of Christian instead of behind him. Christian has stayed at the Palace Beautiful, but Faithful has passed by because it's a sunny day, really, and he has then now got to a place of being ahead of Christian. What is Bunyan meaning by this? When we meet up with Faithful, we'll consider this. Why didn't he stay at the Palace Beautiful? How did he encounter the lions when he passed that way? We'll find out. Just raising a question, Bunyan adds these things to get you thinking, the way he arranges the sequence of events here. "Well, my good porter, may the Lord be with you and increase his blessings on you because of the kindness you have shown me." Then the pilgrim began to move forward, but discretion, piety, charity, and prudence all agreed that they would accompany him down to the bottom of the hill. So they went on together while reviewing their former discussions, that is, until they came to the foot of the hill. Then said Christian on his way down, "I can now appreciate that while it was difficult coming up this hill, so far as I can see, it is even more dangerous going down." To this Prudence responded, "Yes, you're right, for it is a hard matter for a man to go down into the valley of humiliation as you are now doing and not slip in any way. Hence, it is for this reason that we decided to escort you this far." So they continued to go down, though very warily, yet in spite of this, Christian did slip once or twice. And I'm going to point out something now, again, where Bunyan weaves intrigue into this. When Faithful passes through the valley of humiliation, and also Christiana and the four boys in part two, they don't have any problem in the valley of humiliation. But Christian slips, goes down the valley of humiliation, and guess what he meets immediately when he goes down there? A very foul fiend called Apollyon. Let's look further at this. Read on. I'm just raising some points here. Then I saw in my dream that when Pilgrim had reached the bottom of the hill, his good companions gave him a loaf of bread, a bottle of wine, and a cluster of raisins. Then they bid him farewell, so he went on his way. In other words, again, he's given the tokens of remembrance of his Lord to partake of even while he travels, you see. Over the page. Christian enters into battle with Apollyon, this very foul fiend. Now, Christian had not gone far in the valley of humiliation before he was severely tested, for he noticed a very foul fiend coming over the field to meet him. His name was Apollyon, a destroyer. At this, Christian became afraid and immediately pondered whether he ought to retreat or stand his ground. But on further consideration, he realized that he had no armor on his back. And therefore, to expose himself there in fleeing would probably give this foe the advantage with his use of piercing darts. So he determined to risk confrontation with this enemy, for he thought, if I only had in mind the saving of my life, then it would still be best to stand my ground. I'll point this out too. You see, the valley of humiliation is a place to humble those who are a little proud. And when you read of Christian descending from the Palace Beautiful down into the valley of humiliation, what are you told? He slipped a little. In other words, there was an element of pride. He needed to be humbled. When Faithful goes through, he doesn't meet Apollyon. He was a humble man. But the valley of humiliation is to really correct some areas of pride and confidence in pilgrims. And if there's anyone who's going to really humble anyone, it's going to be Apollyon. See, that's the point here. And he's going to be humbled. We read on now. Right-hand column there on page 84. So he continued on, and Apollyon met him. Now this monster was exceedingly hideous to behold. He was clothed with scales like a fish, of which he was most proud. He had wings like a dragon, feet like a bear, and out of his belly belched forth fire and smoke through a mouth like that of a lion. When he drew near to Christian, he looked down upon him with a contemptuous, sneering expression, and then commenced to question him. Then Apollyon says, little way down, so from this I conclude that you are one of my subjects, since the whole of that region belongs to me. That is, he's come from City of Destruction. That's Apollyon's realm. This being true, then how is it that you have run away from your king? Were it not for the fact that my plan is for you to serve me further, I would right now strike you to the ground with one smashing blow. Christian, it is true that I was born in your territories, but your employment was hard, and your wages were very much that a man could not properly live on, since the wages of sin is death. Therefore, when I came to adulthood, I did what other thoughtful people ought to do, that is, seek for better employment. Now, I love the next line. Little way down there, look what Apollyon says. But since you have complained of your duties and salary, let me encourage you to return. I personally promise that every attempt will be made by our government to improve your wages. Yeah. Oh, isn't that good? I love that. But here Bunyan portrays Satan as a serious, implacable foe, a hellish tyrant, truly a foul fiend. He is one to enter into earthly combat with. And we are not to underestimate this enemy to our souls. That is to court defeat. He is not some mere caricature that people laugh at. Over the page 86 at the top. You have done that which the proverb describes, namely, you have exchanged a bad for a worse, though it is quite common for those who profess themselves to be his servants after a while to slip away from his employment and again return to me. Do this and I assure you that all will be well. A little further down, Christian says, what I promised you then was in my non-age. When I was in a relationship with you in the City of Destruction, it was as an immature youth. And besides this, I regard my prince under which whose banner I now stand as able to absolve me of your charges. And even further, he is able to pardon whatever I did in serving you. And besides this, oh, you destroying Apollyon, to be perfectly truthful, I like his employment, his wages, his servants, his government, his company and country infinitely more than yours. Therefore, stop trying to change my mind and leave me alone. I am the Lord's servant and I am determined to follow him. Isn't that courageous? That's in your face with Satan. Now, on the right-hand column, then Pollyon tries another tactic. And he tries to really discourage Christian by pointing out his weaknesses in his travels thus far. Right-hand column there, halfway down, on Pollyon says, but you have already been unfaithful in serving your new Lord, so how is it possible for you to receive any wages from him? Now, on the right-hand page there at the bottom, I've got the charges that Apollyon brings against Christian. Notice this. Apollyon accurately describes Christian's failings in detail. First, his sinking to near despair in the Slough of Despond. Second, his attempt to be loosed of his burden by Mr. Legality. Third, his slothful sleep on the hill difficulty. Four, his thought of returning at the sight of the lions. Five, his continual thoughts of vainglory. Now, page 88. Christian responds to this. All that you say is true. In fact, there is much more that you have left out. But the prince who I serve and honor is very merciful and most willing to forgive. But besides this, these misdemeanors were committed in your territory, where I was educated in them. And as a consequence, I have grieved over them and repented of ever doing such things. Furthermore, I have received a full pardon regarding these crimes from my prince. Now Apollyon gets really angry. And the battle gets even more heated. I am an enemy of this prince of yours. I hate his person, his laws, and his people. For this reason, I have purposely come out here to oppose you. Apollyon, be very careful what you are doing, for I am in the king's highway, and that is the way of holiness. So watch yourself. Now defiantly, and now it is that Apollyon is going to confront him with real physical combat now. Defiantly astride the whole width of the way, he says, I am void of fear in this matter, so prepare yourself to die, for I swear by my infernal den of iniquity that you shall go no further. Here I will spill your soul. This Apollyon was quick to throw a flaming dart directly at his breast, but Christian used the shield of faith, right? Used the shield that was in his hand, deflected it, and so avoided this danger. But in response, Christian drew his sword, since he now realized it was time to stir himself. What? The sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. But Apollyon swiftly hurled a hail of darts that, notwithstanding all the skill the Christian could muster to avoid, yet inflicted wounds on his head as well as his hands and foot. His head where he thinks, his hand where he fights, and his feet where he walks. Now, this assault caused Christian to retreat a little so that Apollyon pressed more forcefully. Yet Christian again took courage and resisted as courageously as he could. This agonizing combat extended beyond half a day, even until Christian was almost exhausted. For you should know that Christian, on account of his wounds, inevitably grew weaker and weaker. Then Apollyon, recognizing his opportunity, began to press closer upon Christian. And now, wrestling with him, heavily threw him to the ground. As a result, Christian's sword flew out of his hand. Then Apollyon gleefully disclaimed, I am sure of you now, when the word of God is distant from you. Then I can claim you easily. And immediately he drew close, intending to inflict a mortal wound. Over the page. At this point, Christian began to despair of staying alive. Now, here's the sovereignty of God, the sovereignty of Christ. But as God would have it, while Apollyon was preparing his final blow so as to destroy this good man, yet Christian was enabled to nimbly stretch out his hand and regain a grip on his sword. And at the same time, he cried out, do not rejoice against me, O my implacable enemy, for when I fall, I shall arise. Then he gave Apollyon a deadly thrust, which caused him to draw back as if he had received a fatal wound. Now, in perceiving this, Christian moved in upon him while declaring, "Even so, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us." As a result, Apollyon quickly spread out his dragon's wings and fled away, so the Christian saw him no more. Dramatic, biblical, encouraging, isn't it? Equal to any modern fiction of some military or galactic conquest, isn't it? Breathtaking in the way it's described. Now, unless any man had seen and heard the intensity of this combat as I did, he could not possibly imagine the yelling and hideous roaring of Apollyon, as well as his dragon-like manner of speaking. On the other hand, what sighs and groans there were that burst forth from Christian's heart. During the whole encounter, I never saw him give so much as one pleasant look. That is, until he was aware of his wounding of Apollyon with his two-edged sword. But then he smiled broadly and at the same time looked upward. However, on the whole, this was the most dreadful sight that I have ever seen. Right-hand column, a little way down. Then came to Christian a hand in which were some of the leaves of the tree of life. And taking these, he applied them to the wounds that he had received in the battle. As a result, he was immediately healed. He also sat down in that same place to eat bread and drink from the bottle that had earlier been given to him by the ladies, you remember, at the Palace Beautiful. So being refreshed, he prepared himself for moving forward in his journey. Now his sword was already drawn in his hand, for he said, "I do not know if some other enemy may be near at hand." Now he's much more sensitive about what could lay ahead. Even so, he did not meet with any further opposition from Apollyon. That is, throughout the remainder of this valley. Now, another valley confronts us over the page, from one valley to another. "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil, for thou art with me." That's, of course, Psalm 23, and this is what it's based upon. Page 92. Now, at the end of this valley, there was another valley of the shadow of death, and it was necessary for Christian to pass through it because the way to the celestial city was in that direction. Now, this valley was a very solitary, lonely place. The prophet Jeremiah describes it as a wilderness, a land of deserts and of pits, a land of drought and of the shadow of death, a land that no man except the Christian passes through and where no man dwells. Further down, so I, Bunyan, saw in my dream that when Christian arrived at the borders of the valley of the shadow of death, two men met him there, namely children of those spies who had earlier delivered an evil report of the promised land, and quickly determined to turn back. Right-hand column there, and then Christian says at the top, "But what was it exactly that you saw?" These men are again going back. They're fearful, discouraged, as you see. "What did we see? Why, it was the valley itself being as dark as pitch. We also saw that the hobgoblins and satyrs and dragons of the pit, and in that valley we also heard a continual howling and yelling as if from people experiencing unspeakable misery, people who sat bound in affliction and irons. And over that valley there hung the discouraging clouds of confusion while death spread its wings and hovered over it. To sum up, it was a thoroughly dreadful sight. Everywhere there was nothing but disorder." Now, this is slightly different from the valley of the shadow of death, which Christian and Hopeful will cover when we're at the end of this allegory, when they cross the river of death. When Christian and Hopeful actually personally experience death, that will be described there. Here we have the valley of the shadow of death. It's related, but not quite the same. It speaks of the things associated with death, the pit of darkness, travail, Sheol, the mind contemplating death, the netherworld, as we say, and a discouraging place. That's what it is, you see. Then we read, "So Christian parted with the two men and continued to move forward, though his sword remained drawn at the ready, for fear that he might be assaulted. Then I saw in my dream that for the whole length of this valley, on the right-hand side there was a very deep ditch, and this was the same ditch into which the blind have led the blind for endless ages, with the result that they all have miserably perished. Similarly, on the left-hand side, there was a very dangerous quagmire into which, if even a good man fell, he could find no solid ground for his feet to stand upon. In other words, this valley is like walking on a razor's edge. In the darkness, in the swirling influences of death and hell and Satan himself, you know, out of the pit. Now at this place, the way was extremely narrow, and for this reason, Christian was severely tested as he pressed on. Top of page 94. When in the dark, he was careful to shun the ditch on the right-hand side, but when he found himself in danger of stumbling into the quagmire on the left-hand side. Moreover, when he attempted to escape the quagmire, unless he was very cautious, he would find himself on the brink of falling into the ditch further down. Now, in the middle of this valley here, I noticed the location of the very mouth of hell. It, in fact, being hard up against the narrow way. I call it a short way, shortcut to hell, if you like. At the sight of this, Christian wondered what he should do, since so much flame and smoke were belching forth, accompanied with sparks and hideous noises. These fearful eruptions seemed quite unruffled, considering Christian's sword, as had been the case with Apollyon. So the trembling pilgrim found it necessary to resort to another weapon called all prayer. You'll read that in Ephesians 6. When it goes down and lists the weapons of our warfare, it then speaks of our and praying with all prayer. What's that effect? And Bunyan, in that list of weapons, as it were, includes this as a final weapon. All prayer is a weapon. He found it necessary to resort to another weapon called all prayer. Because even his sword was not working on this occasion. So again, the final weapon is all prayer. In using this, I was able to hear him cry out, "O Lord, I implore you to deliver my soul." So Christian continued to pray in this manner for a long while. At the same time as he crept along the way, the flames of hell seemed to lick ever so close to him. He also heard doleful voices and rushes back and forth, so that sometimes he thought he would be torn in pieces or trodden underfoot like mire in the streets. Right-hand column, a little way down. One thing I could not avoid mentioning by way of observation is how poor Christian now appeared to be so confused. As I watched him, he did not even seem to know his own voice. Just when he came close to the mouth of the burning pit, one of the wicked ones sneaked up behind him, ever so softly, and whispered in his ear many suggestive and distressing blasphemies. These, he was convinced, had originated from his own mind. Very perceptive of Bunyan here. In the life of the Christian, sometimes a dream or something will come to you and you think, that's foul, that's ungodly, that's unclean. Where'd that come from? You know? And you may feel, I repudiate it, but why does it come to me? It's the murkiness of the mind and the soul in a sinful carcass that we have there. And Bunyan portrays this, knowing that it happens. And then he portrays it as a devilish, subtle approach from behind, coming up to his ear and making whispers that he thinks he's thinking, even though they are devilishly injected into his life. You see, that's the point. They have a satanic origin, you see. So in this manner, Christian was more sorely pressed in his journey than at any other time, since it troubled him to think that he could possibly blaspheme he who he loved so much. In Grace Abounding, you will read of a particular occasion where Bunyan felt he was tempted to even to blaspheme Christ. And for a time he thought he had. He was delivered from that, and you'll read about that in Grace Abounding. When Christian had traveled to this in this depressed condition for some considerable time, he then thought he heard the voice of a man on pilgrimage ahead of him saying, "Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil, for you are with me." As a result, he felt very glad, and that for the following reasons. Simply put, that there's company, there's another pilgrim ahead, and there's more comfort in going with a company than going solo. That's the point. That will come up as another principle later on. At the bottom of this column, eventually the light of the morning dawned at this Christian exclaimed, "He has turned the shadow of death into the morning." Now, that a new day had come, he looked back, not out of desire to return, but rather to see more clearly by daylight exactly what hazards he had traversed in the dark. Further down. So Christian was greatly moved with his deliverance from all the dangers of his solitary journey thus far. Now these trials, though he feared them more than ever, yet had become more apparent to him because the light of day had exposed them. So with the sun now rising, this advantage offered Christian even more mercy. For it is to be noted that though the first part of the valley of the shadow of death was dangerous, far more dangerous. For it is to be noted that though the first part of the valley of the shadow of death was dangerous, yet the second part ahead of him was, if at all possible, far more dangerous. This was because throughout the remainder of the valley there were set innumerable snares, traps, catching devices, nets, as well as there being countless pits, pitfalls, deep holes, and unsafe ledges in those depths, which again calls for walking circumspectly. Had it now been as dark as was formerly the case, though he possessed 1,000 souls, yet they all would have been lost in this region. But as I said, the sun was now rising. For this reason, the pilgrim declared, "His candle shines on my head, and by his light I go through the darkness." Therefore, in this light, Christian came to the end of the valley. Now I saw in my dream that at the end of the valley there lay blood, bones, ashes, and the mangled bodies of men, even of pilgrims who had earlier come this way. And while I was musing over what could be the reason for these remains, I noticed a short way ahead a cave in which two giants, Pope and Pagan, here they had lived for a long time and by power and tyranny had cruelly put to death the men whose bones, blood, and ashes lay before him. I will tell you this, John Bunyan had no time for Roman Catholicism. And I will even prove that to you later on when we get down to what is the essence of the gospel. What is the gospel in its essence? And I will tell you right now, I believe the Catholic Church teaches another gospel. It really does. We'll explain that later on. If you wonder about that, I'll explain that very carefully. It's Bunyan who explains it. I'll show you later on. And so you've got this gentleman Pope. All right. At this place, Christian passed by without much danger. And this somewhat surprised me. This is, now again, notice, there is Bunyan editorializing. See that? At this place, Christian passed by without much danger. And this somewhat surprised me. That's Bunyan. See? But subsequently, I have learned that Pagan has been dead for many a day. And as for the other, though he is still alive, yet on account of his old age and the many shrewd conflicts that he met with in his younger days, he has grown crazy and stiff in his joints. As a result, he can now do little more than sit in the mouth of his cave, grinning at pilgrims as they go by and biting his nails, being frustrated because he cannot intercept them. I have two questions concerning Pagan. Has he died? I don't think so. Especially the rise of the Muslim religion. I suppose you might say it's not technically pagan because they believe in a deity, but nevertheless, paganism in secular America is very common. And then Pope, is he now senile? Impotent? Oh, I don't think so at all, friends. Not in a, for a moment. You've got to understand, of course, Bunyan is writing in the 17th century. And he is writing in a time when the Roman Catholic Church has taken a tremendous beating through the Reformation. And Europe has essentially been liberated through the gospel, through the printing of the Word of God. And so Bunyan is writing in that time, and he sees him decrepit and beaten down, you know, and whipped, you see, but he rises again, that's for sure. Over the page. Christian overtakes and converses with Faithful. We'll just introduce this. Now as Christian went on his way, he came to a slight ascent which was specially designed so that pilgrims could more easily see ahead of them. Therefore Christian went up and looking forward, he saw Faithful in the distance, intent on his journey. Then did Christian call out loudly, "Ho, ho, so here, here, look here, wait, let me catch up and I will be your companion." At this, Faithful looked behind him, causing Christian to again cry out, "Wait, wait till I catch up with you." But Faithful replied, "No, I travel with my life at stake, and the avenger of blood is close behind." This reply somewhat moved Christian, so mustering all his strength, he quickly caught up with Faithful and, in fact, raced past him so that the last had become first. As a result, Christian smiled with a sense of self-congratulation. He felt proud of now being ahead of his brother, yet not paying attention to his feet. He suddenly stumbled and fell to the ground and was unable to get up. That is until Faithful came up to help him. There is again Christian overcome with a little sense of pride. Looking back, I'm ahead of you now, you see. Pride comes before all. He trips over, falls flat in his face. And with that, the question is, how does Faithful respond to this? Well, serve you right. Is that what he does? No, not at all. Oh, no. Read on. "Then I saw in my dream that both of them went on very lovingly together, and they had delightful conversation about all the things that had happened to them on their pilgrimage." So Christian spoke. It reminds me of the verse of Charles Wesley. "He bids us build each other up and gather into one. To our high calling's glorious hope, we hand in hand go on." And Faithful didn't scoff at his brother and rebuke him. He came tenderly with a hand of help and lifted him up. And the two of them went very lovingly on together. A little further down, Faithful says, "Dear friend, I had thought of enjoying your company even from our town, but you did get quite a start on me. Therefore, I was forced to come this far on my own." But how did he get ahead? The purpose, he passed by the Palace Beautiful, didn't stay there, so he gets ahead, you see. What's the answer to this? I think I'll just give the answer, I think, and then we'll close this session and come back here. What you'll find here is, we'll get in a moment, you'll read that Faithful tells us what happened when he came up to the lions. He found them asleep. It was a sunny day. It wasn't sunset at all. It was the midday and the lions are snoozing and he passes by them. He's not attacked by them at all. So he comes up, the porter bids him enter, but he says, "No, I don't need to go in there," he said, and he walks by. He passes by in the daylight, you see, and that's how he gets ahead. Who is he? I will suggest that he is what we would call a faithful conformist pastor. In other words, John Bunyan, for instance, had a friend north of Bedford he was at a town called Yeldon, and I'm trying to think of his name. William Dell, his name was. William Dell. He was an Anglican minister in Yeldon, about 11 miles north of Bedford. On one occasion, William Dell, who was a godly man, very godly man, he was finally pushed out of the Anglican church. But before that happened, he was pastoring in Yeldon. On one occasion, he invited John Bunyan to preach on Christmas Day up in Yeldon. And John Bunyan went up there and preached in this Anglican church. Apparently, the people in the church weren't too happy with this, and they complained to William Dell, their vicar. They said, "Why did you have again this nonconformist, unlearned tinker come and preach here?" And William Dell said, "I'd much rather have this tinker come and preach the Word of God than some unconverted Church of England man." And so Bunyan had respect even in the Anglican church, though he had no part of that himself. He was totally nonconformist. He would yet fraternize if he found a minister in the Church of England was truly godly and born again. And such was William Dell. So he had fellowship with them, you see. And there were others in that category too. He wasn't so narrow that he would not fellowship them on some degree of separation, something like that. No, he preached up there in that church on the Sunday on the Christmas Day service. And the point I'm getting at here is, anyway, this man now comes up to the lions. They don't snarl and snap at him. Why? Because he belongs to the established Church of England still at this point. He's not interested in attending, really, a nonconformist church, the Palace Beautiful. So he comes up. The lions don't snarl. They're asleep because he's still in the Church of England. He passes by, you see. He's not a nonconformist pastor. He gets ahead, but we're told here, you see, the two very lovingly go on together. So Bunyan was very conservative and evangelical, but he was not a super separatist, I call him. Let's come back in our next session. We'll take right up then at the conversation. There's much more that Faithful will reveal in his testimony. Thank you.